Back at it for you on a big Tuesday edition, October 27th of Connecticut Today. What's the pace of criminal justice reform and violence in the streets in Connecticut? We talked to former criminal justice czar under Governor Dan Malloy, Mike Lawler, about that. Mike, a longtime prosecutor and a longtime professor of criminology at the University of New Haven. Bottom of the 4 o'clock hour, we gave you some of Governor Ned Lamont's latest remarks on voting safely in Connecticut during the COVID-19 pandemic. 5 o'clock hour, we talked about what African-American voters, particularly black men, may do on election day. Will they vote in better numbers than expected? For President Trump, we talked about that and more. To policing and law enforcement, longtime East Haven Democratic state rep, former criminal justice czar under former Governor Dan Malloy, who's now in the hinterlands of Maine, and just appointed a police commissioner in New Haven, Mike Lawler joins us. Mike, Paul here. How are you?
Hey, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm just surviving, getting up out of bed. Everything's good, you know, so I'm going to stop complaining, you know, although I get paid paid to complain here, too. But so, Mike, you're now a police commissioner in the New Haven area. You're still at UNH. You worked with the governor. You've been in criminal justice for the majority of your life. Where do we stand now, Mike, on this whole criminal justice reform thing, which I know and you know because we see and we talk about the stories, still is rubbing some of the law enforcement people the wrong way here in the state? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right? I mean, a lot has changed over the last 40 years or so. And as you just pointed out, I started my criminal justice career as a prosecutor back in the early 1980s. And, just to put things in perspective, in the early 1990s, that was really the peak of crime, you know, shootings, murders, everything else. And since that time in Connecticut and pretty much around the country, we're down to about one third as many reported crimes as was the case in the early 1990s. So that's good, right? There's less crime. Over that same period of time, you know, police end up having to deal with all of the most complicated problems in our communities, usually the problems no one else knows what to do about. And so by default, the police get saddled with all this stuff. And I think over time, that's created a lot of different problems. I mean, just one example would be dealing with persons with mental illness, right? I mean, that really takes a specialized approach. And, you know, there's a lot of people in the community that are not getting the proper kind of care, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just a recipe for disaster to have someone who's off their meds, having a mental break, and then dealing with uniformed police officers. Just a bad idea. So I think what you're seeing now is the consequence of that. And my hope is that over the next few years, the quote-unquote reforms that are being kicked around really focus on finding better ways to deal with these kinds of problems so the police can deal with sort of like the true sort of predatory, violent criminal types. And I think that's the trend that's starting to take shape.
And that predatory criminal, Mike, you and I see it every day here in Bridgeport, New Haven, Hartford. There seems to be, you know, not necessarily people who are mentally ill or having mental problems, Mike, but there's always this cadre of people, and it's not a lot. I used to talk with John DeStefano a lot when he was mayor of New Haven, and even when I talked with Joe Ganim here in Bridgeport about it. Mike, there's not a lot of people doing this, but there's that core of people that seems to have, at times, because of gangs or whatever, you know, a small regard for human life. And you see this taking its toll on its communities. What do we do about that?
So I think you're right. But you're talking about a very specific problem. You're talking about basically shootings and murders.
Yeah.
Particularly in our cities. And as you point out, you can, if you have the right data, you can figure out who are the 200 or 300 people in Bridgeport or any other city who are the most likely to either get killed or kill somebody. And as it turns out, that is a list that's actually been compiled. You know, you may have heard of something called Project Longevity, which is all about identifying who those people are and focusing on them, not just with a punitive approach, but also combined with some sort of escape valve for them if they want to take advantage of it. And so this is hard to do, and it does require the community to buy into it. And I think with varying levels of success. It's it is underway in Bridgeport, New Haven, and Hartford. I think New Haven is probably the most advanced in this regard. But but just to be clear, that's just one dimension of sort of crime problem, right? And when it comes to murders in our state, you know, that's usually about at least half, sometimes two thirds of murders would be in that category, sort of group and gang related, usually kind of senseless shootings over stupid stuff like disrespecting somebody, et cetera, et cetera. But the other thing about this, which I think is a little bit more encouraging, is that more often than not, the people who get wrapped up in this type of lifestyle, let's say, have a very similar story behind, you know, a lifetime story. You know, a lot of them were foster care to start with. They just had no support at all. They're, you know, victims of sexual abuse and witness to domestic violence and just all kinds of violence. So sometimes you can figure out who these really young people, I'm talking about kids like in elementary school, and try and intervene with them in a way that makes it less likely they're going to end up in this boat down the road. And the good news in Connecticut, and I think this came as a surprise to me, but I think certainly a surprise to most people, is that the number of young people, I mean, like under age 25, getting arrested every year is dropping dramatically.
That's good.
Like maybe 70% since 10 years ago. The number of older people getting arrested is more or less the same, but it's this really dramatic reduction among young people getting into trouble at all. So that's a good sign, I think, you know, that things will continue getting better. But you can't lose sight of the fact that the most serious crime, obviously, is homicide, and that's needs to be a focus.
Mike Lawler is a guest. Mike, hang on for a minute. We'll be right back to you. Mike Lawler, currently a professor for many years now at the University of New Haven, a New Haven police commissioner. He was a longtime prosecutor, and he was a criminal justice czar for former Governor Dan Malloy, keeping an eye on crime all throughout Connecticut. More with Mike Lawler straight ahead, right after Traffic and Weather Together on WICC. As we talk about criminal justice reform, about 5 minutes left here with former East Haven Democratic State Rep Mike Lawler. He was Governor Dan Malloy's right-hand guy in criminal justice reform, former career prosecutor as well. Mike, what is going on now with the criminal justice reform package that passed the legislature? And I know, for example, the adjustments to police liability, Mike, I know that those don't kick in until July 1 because they're supposed to be a further look into that as to what effect that may have. What are your thoughts on all this?
So the police accountability bill that passed in August, you know, has a pretty wide variety of changes, most of which affect the way law enforcement does their job. But I teach a course at the university on search and seizure law, and also about how police are liable if they violate people's constitutional rights. And the reason I say that is it is so complicated to explain this thing called qualified immunity, which is what people are talking about. So here's the thing. I mean, the bottom line is this. So there's a federal qualified immunity thing, and then there's a state qualified immunity thing. So the state legislature modified the state version of qualified immunity. It makes it it changes the definition of when you get that kind of immunity, right? But the one thing that seems to be very much misunderstood, especially by people in the law enforcement community, is under no circumstances do the actual police officers have to pay anything out of their pocket, right? I mean, if you're a police officer and you get sued for something you did on the job, and if the lawsuit is successful, then it's your employer that pays. There's a state law that says that, and it's always been like that, and it has not been changed. So it doesn't really change the chances that you would end up paying anything. The qualified immunity thing is something that makes it almost impossible to get in front of a jury with a case. So basically, if someone sues a police officer, and then the police almost always would argue qualified immunity, a judge would decide whether it applies in a particular case. If it does apply, the case is dismissed. If it does not apply, you get in front of a jury, right? So it's not really a big change. I think it's got more symbolic significance than anything else. And most of these lawsuits actually happen in federal court, not in state court, and that has not changed. But it sounds like that might be up for discussion next year when Congress comes back in.
Well, because a civil rights violation is a federal violation, not a state violation, correct?
When it comes to being a crime, we're talking about suing people. So under both federal law and state law, you can sue government officials for violating your constitutional rights. What qualified immunity says is, and this is a gross oversimplification, but if, let's say you're suing a police officer, if the police officer says, what I did was objectively reasonable under the circumstances. In other words, I was not aware of any specific law or court decision that says I cannot do what I did. Mm-hmm. Then you're more or less entitled to have the thing dismissed. And that's just for civil suits, right? If you willfully violating someone's civil rights can get you arrested, right? That's a different thing. But we're just talking about lawsuits and how difficult it is to get to a jury. And what happened in Connecticut is not that big of a change, really, in my opinion. But it's a symbolic thing, and people are very focused on that.
All right, Mike Lawler. Mike, thank you. Currently a professor at the University of New Haven, former prosecutor, former criminal justice czar on the state level with Governor Dan Malloy among his resume items. Mike, you chose not to follow the governor, the former governor, up to the hinterlands of Maine. You stayed here. No?
I've been teaching at the University of New Haven since 1995, actually. And I basically had an 8-year leave of absence to go work for the governor. But I live in New Haven. I love it here. The beach is way better here than it is in Maine, that's for sure. But, Governor Malloy, I know for a fact, he didn't want to be a lobbyist. He didn't want to join a law firm. He didn't want to go to Washington. He really wanted to be in charge of something. And he loved it. And that's where he ended
good
up.
For him. So. All right, Mike, be good. We'll talk to you down the road. Mike Lawler, thank you, Mike. Be good.
Anytime, Paul. See you.
All right, Mike Lawler there.
Yeah, we do it with integrity. And I think from that point, when the infection rates were going down, we said we have no idea what it's going to look like in early November. And I want to make sure that in this public health pandemic, we do everything to make sure that we can keep our state safe, make it so our seniors and those with pre-existing conditions and anybody who didn't feel safe, they could vote right here early and not have to get in line. And I think that was really far-sighted. Today, I just got the numbers. Our infection rate scooted up to 4.1%. Another, I think it's 22 hospitalizations. That's not unexpected, but it still wakes you up like a cold shower. It's the highest numbers we've had since very early June. I think we could see what was going on in a lot of our states around the country and even states in our region. And that's why it's so important that we maintain all the social distancing and wearing the mask when you come and vote, either by dropping it off right here at the official ballot box. We have hundreds of these around the state, making it easier for you to vote and vote safely. And if you come in person, do that safely. As Deirdre said, the middle of the day is probably the least crowded time, and you can get that done. Just talking to registrars and clerks, and look, we've got the election almost ends on November 3rd. It started weeks ago, and people have been voting for an awful long time. And along with public health and safety, it was really important to me that we give you confidence. Hey, thank you for voting. Give you confidence that your vote counts, and this is a process with integrity. And look, I think the president's been casting some shade upon the voting process, casting some shade upon the integrity of voting right now. I don't know what his end game is, but I can tell you that here in the state of Connecticut, and I think 49 other states, we're doing everything we can to give you confidence that your vote counts, it matters, and it's being cast with integrity. And if you talk to the clerks and the registrars, we have hundreds of folks who have come in to volunteer as poll watchers, said the only thing that could slow us down is if some of those cranky tabulators slow up, and more importantly, supervision. And it's gonna take us a little bit of time to get all those votes counted, even though We did allow the bill that allows processing the Friday before the election and counting at 6 a.m. the day of election. But I want to get those numbers out as soon as we can with integrity to give people a sense of confidence that this is an election that's going to take place. Look, it's often by the last week of a campaign, you know, the two candidates start blending into a muted shade of gray. And I think you've got a black and white contrast. And I think that's going to bring out an awful lot of voters. And I think that's good. I hate to say it, even this pandemic, I love the fact that people know a vote matters. They're stepping up and they're going to cast their vote. And I hope very soon on election day or soon thereafter, we're going to know what direction our country is taking. And in the meantime, doing it safely in the middle of this pandemic with those sobering infection numbers, I appreciate what you all can do to keep us safe. Thanks, everybody.
1 week from tonight, we'll be talking about the next presidential election, the next General Assembly election here in Connecticut, Congress and all that. And we'll be looking for indications of what the black vote, the African-American vote, does in this country. There have been all these stories floating around that Donald Trump may do better than the normal Republican candidate does, particularly with black men. And there are some high-profile African-American men entertainers who are saying it's time to leave the Democratic Party. They quickly get shouted down by other black entertainers. It goes round and round. Joining us right now is a black conservative pundit, Autry Pruitt. He's CEO of the New Journey PAC, and he's an author of the book Plains, Steak, and Water, Defending Donald J. Trump. Autry, Paul here on WICC. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Paul. Thank you so much for having me on board.
And where does that title, Plains, Steak, and Water, come from? What's that about?
Back in 2016, Mitt Romney gave a speech, and he said, whatever happened to Trump Plains, whatever happened to Trump Steak, whatever happened to Trump Water. And the emphasis is, in the last chapter of the book, I talk about that the emphasis is the fact that it's not about that Plains, Steak, and Water didn't succeed. It's the fact that Trump tried. And that's what is the problem with the Republicans now, is Republicans don't even want to try. Right. The reason why Donald Trump, everybody's like, oh, he's failed at most of the stuff and he's barely succeeded at real estate. That's BS. Right. He's tried 25 things and failed at 23 of them, succeeded at two. Well, that's better than you've tried two and failed at two.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah. Good point. I get that. And you know, Autry, you talk about Mitt Romney and that cadre of Republicans. And listen, I respect them, but I think precisely what you mentioned, Autry, is why a lot of the traditional Republican crowd that would never even try to get black votes has it in for Donald Trump, because he goes out there and, listen, he says things that not a lot of people are comfortable with, but I think they're just jealous that he's got the, as my Italian people say, the guglions, to go out there and to try and actually approach the black vote. Whether he's successful or not, he's got the guts to do it. I don't think a lot of traditional Republicans have the guts to do it or even care, frankly.
They don't care. They don't. I've had conversations. I happen to be black American, and I've had conversations with Republican people that say, well, I don't really want to go get the black vote, because if I get the black vote, it's going to bring out more blacks, and then that's going to up Democrat turnout. What kind of horse crap is that? Right? This is they don't care. They do not care. And by the way, white voters, let me tell you something right now. Poor white voters, Republicans, Trump is the first to come along and care. The campaign in 2016, when I was a surrogate for him, he sent me out to poor rural areas and told me that's where I should be. That's where I should be going for Pennsylvania. That's what he said. Right? He said, you should be out there among poor whites talking to them, because they don't see your color. They just see what you've been able to do. Right? And these are the poor whites that voted for Obama.
Yeah, as a black man, as an African American of the U.S., Autry, what do you make of a lot of discussions among some pretty prominent black entertainers, business people? You know, the latest, I think, being Ice Cube and all these people saying, hey, I get why some black men are into Donald Trump. Talk a little about that.
Well, what I make of it is this: the steel term from Hillary Clinton, the glass ceiling, is being broken. It's being cracks. There's about a million cracks in it, because after 50 years, you're looking around and you're saying, why haven't the conditions changed? If you're so, think about this. For those of you who don't know much about politics, in Congress right now, there's a group called the Congressional Black Caucus. They make up about 53 members of Congress. They're all African-American Democrats. They're members of the Congressional Black Caucus. Right now, they could, if they wanted to, control every single vote that comes through. Because if they didn't vote with Nancy Pelosi, she couldn't get anything through. Well, if that's the case, why aren't they activating their power to use it to help the black community? Right? If they're so concerned that there aren't enough black people being represented in Congress in higher positions of power in general, then why don't they use their authority and say, hey, we need to have a black Speaker of the House? They haven't done that, because the Democrats at the end of the day are not about helping people. They're about putting money in their own pockets. Just look at Hollywood. They lie. They build walls around their houses, but they don't want to have a wall around the country. They have security guards with guns, but you can't have a gun. They don't pay their taxes, but they want you to pay all the taxes on the planet.
Autry Pruitt is the guest. He's a leading black conservative, CEO of the New Journey PAC. He was a surrogate for President Trump in 2016. The other day, Autry, we saw Sean Combs, Diddy, came out and said, it's time for a black political party. Enough of this. What do you think of that?
Well, it's not time for a black political party. You don't need that. All you need to do, it doesn't even take, by the way, 50% of black folks. If 25% of black folks said, we're going to vote for those who are delivering to our community, period, you control the election. Right? All these elections, Trump's last election, 2016, Bush, even Obama's, If the black vote swung 20% in one way or the other, that there it goes. You don't need a black political party. You don't have really a white political party. All you need is black voters to not vote based on pigmentation. Vote on who delivers for you. I know 50 Cent has been shaky because some people came out and he got scared of his brand. But what he said originally was true. What 50 yeah. Cent said originally was true. I don't care about Trump being racist. I don't care about all that. He's delivering stuff. If he's racist, so be it. I don't think Trump is racist. But if he's racist, so be it. He's delivering to our community, and that's what we need.
You point out something in the material sent to me that I do remember. You look at the state of Florida, and Ron DeSantis, the Republican governor down there, big Trump buddy, now already being rumored, you know, for 2024, if the president wins or loses. He made a big push for African-American voters in Florida when Governor DeSantis was elected a few years ago. And a lot of people say that's the reason he won.
Oh, yes, DeSantis. DeSantis did something even better. DeSantis was up against an African-American male named Andrew Gillum, who at that time was high respect. I know since then all this crap has come out about him, but at the time no one knew any of that. He was highly respected African-American male. And Governor DeSantis went in and ran on a platform with black women called School Choice. And black women turned out, about 30,000 of them turned out to vote for him, and they voted on one single issue, and that was school choice. That should tell Republicans right there that you have a group within the black community that doesn't vote on skill color. They vote on the issues. And all Governor DeSantis did, time after time after time after time, by the way, with our help, time after time after time after time, all he did was say school choice, school choice, school choice, and school choice. That was a winning message. It's a winning issue.
Yeah, because getting your kids or your grandkids or your nieces or nephews into quality schools, Autry, is not a racial issue. I know that. Listen. People who live in underserved neighborhoods, they want a good education just like a white person does who lives behind a gated community for their kids.
Yeah. Yes. That's absolutely true.
Autry, if folks want to find out more about New Journey PAC and your group, what can they do?
The best thing to do now is go to newjourneypack.org. That's new, N-E-W, journey, P-A-C, newjourneypack.org. You can read about us there, see candidates we endorse. You can, and by the way, we also run on a lot of issues as well. Read the background, read the vision. You can email me if you want to, info@newjourneypack.org, and we'll respond to you. We're a little busy right now because of election.
But we'll I can imagine. Well, keep that coffee going and the pizza. That's always good during Election Day. Believe me, been there, done that. Autry Pruitt. Yeah. Autry, thank you. We appreciate it, and good luck in the future.
Much,
thank you, sir. Thank you. Autry Pruitt, A-U-T-R-Y, Pruitt, P-R-U-I-T-T, New Journey, J-O-U-R-N-E-Y, like the band, New Journey PAC, P-A-C.org. And, of course, a PAC is a political action committee, so he does, funnel money, money for political action. That's what it is, so.